It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For nearly 15 years, the City of Asylum has worked to build a community for writers, readers, and Pittsburgh neighbors while providing sanctuary for artists who are under a threat in their home countries. And the group has a new executive director, Kristen Weslow. Welcome to the Confluence and welcome to Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
I said new executive director. Just how new? Isn't this the start of your second week on the job?
Yes. So I started last Monday. I'm 6 days in.
And you're still here.
I'm still here. I keep coming back. So okay. I love it.
So most recently, you were a director of institutional giving at American Public Media, one of the largest producers and distributors of public media programming. And of course, our listeners are very familiar. They hear some of those voices on WESA. But what attracted you to this position, executive director of City of Asylum?
Sure. So I've always worked in nonprofits. It's just kind of where my heart is. And I actually attended a conference at the National Endowment for Humanities a few years ago and heard someone give a presentation about City of Asylum. And as I was listening to how it's a mix of helping exiled writers and building community on the north side and jazz and music and literary programs and film, I just got more and more excited about the program. At the same time, my daughter was getting ready to come to Pitt as a student. Oh. And so I knew I was going to be in Pittsburgh. And I just started following the organization and felt like, wow, if there was ever a place that I would want to put my name in the hat to be executive director, it was City of Asylum. And so I just started visiting, keeping my eye on the organization, and then lo and behold, the position opened up.
You mentioned your career with nonprofits. You've worked for arts organizations, social service agencies. What do you think you'll draw from those experiences to help you with City of Asylum?
I think the biggest thing is just those aspects of nonprofit management that bring it all together. Obviously, fundraising is the big one, and that's been a focus of mine ever since I started at the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And also really helping a staff embrace the mission of the organization, work strategically toward big goals, and bring the community into that conversation. So I think City of Asylum is ready and wants that next level of leadership so we can start our next 15 years.
I want to talk about the future in just a couple of minutes. How will your work specifically in multicultural settings, including working with immigrant women, how will that help you with City of Asylum?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned over time, especially when I've worked with people from other countries and other backgrounds, is a sense of hospitality and welcoming. And that was another huge aspect that really drew me to City of Asylum and to Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh as a welcoming city, it just doesn't get any better than this. And I think City of Asylum and the approach that they take with the artists and with the community is really emblematic of how welcoming a city Pittsburgh is.
Let's talk a little bit more about the mission. How does it work in terms of providing asylum to the international writers? How many at a time? How do you make accommodations for them?
Sure. So we have homes on the north side of Pittsburgh that we have rehabbed, and that is where the writers live. We have writers, long-term writers who come with us for several years, and then we also have short-term residencies throughout the year. The writers that come to us from other countries for the two-year residency, we are part of an international network, which is called the International Cities of Refuge Network, and the writers actually apply to them when they are seeking protection and asylum in other countries. And then that network contacts us, finds out, you know, how much room do we have? Do we have space for a new writer at this point in time? And then we work with them to decide if it's a good fit for this community and take it from there.
So they are the conduit between you and the writers?
Correct.
It's not just about providing safety asylum, if you would. I mentioned these writers, they're under threat in their home countries, but it's also the opportunity to continue writing and have those literary works read, isn't it?
That's correct. And that's one of the reasons why 2 years ago we developed Alphabet City, which is in the old Masonic Temple right next to the Garden Theater.
On the north side.
On the north side, yes. And so we have community programs, hundreds of community programs every year. That's where our opportunity lies, to highlight the writers, to give them a sense of community, so that they're not just writing in their homes. But it's really been amazing how the Northside community in and of itself has embraced the writers as part of the family there.
Well, yeah, it's not just secluding them in a safe house.
Right.
It's getting them to be part of the community. How has the Northside embraced these writers, these artists through the years?
Attendance at our programs is probably the highest indicator. We actually often have waiting lists. Our programs are free. All of them are free, but we ask people to register so we know how many people to expect. They're frequently waitlisted and filled to capacity. The writers also, we have an active network with partners in the city. And so they will often be invited to speak at some of the local colleges and universities and other partnering organizations.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest today is the new executive director of the City of Asylum, Kristen Weslow. Kristen, can we expect some new residents of the City of Asylum in the near future?
Yeah, so things are going to get pretty exciting in the next, I would say, 3 to 4 months. We're approaching our 15th anniversary year, which will sort of kick off in the fall. And we're expecting at least one new writer from Ethiopia to arrive probably late April, early May, and then possibly a second writer shortly thereafter from Sudan.
Mm-hmm. How long is that? You were describing a little bit earlier the process of seeing if it's a good fit. Generally, what is the length of time before that match starts, or at least is approached, and then the actual no? We have a place for you. We would love to have you here.
You know, that is one question 6 days into the job that I am not able to answer. Check back with me in a couple months.
I got you on that one. So the countries, though, you mentioned Ethiopia, another one possibly from Africa. How many different countries through the years would you say that the City of Asylum have welcomed writers from?
It truly is international. Right now, we have one writer from Bangladesh, another one from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
We've had others from Iran and really just all over the place. One of the things coming up with our 15th anniversary is we would like to have a reunion of the writers that have been here over the years. And so that will be a good opportunity to get a sense of just how global our organization is.
Okay. How do you make sure that their works are translated or available for Pittsburghers to be able to read?
Yeah, so we have program staff who are focused on supporting the writers in their creative endeavors, their professional development, and then also any just support that they might need as far as just being a regular resident of the community. So medical support, support after they're here for 2 years. Many go on to look for work.
Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, the Cities of Asylum is actually a network, but unlike others, Pittsburgh's is a grassroots organization, is that fair to say?
Right.
And others have sort of a parent organization, whether it's a university or some other established organization. What challenges does that pose? Oh, what maybe freedom does it give you?
Yeah, I think freedom is more along the lines of, you know, we are supporting the writers through community programs that we program. So we're not beholden to a university that might have a writer who's joining as a writer in residence or a teaching position. So that allows us to get kind of creative with the programs, and we are able to do things like Jazz Poetry Month, which we have every fall, that might be a combination of programs that's not necessarily happening in another situation. But you're correct. We are the, from what I understand, the only freestanding city of asylum. Mm-hmm. And one designation that that affords us is that we're considered the headquarters for cities of asylum.
Oh, we have just about a minute and a half left. Is there an intentional effort to involve children to help them maybe have a grasp and appreciation early on of multiculturalism?
Yeah, so we have a few things. We're doing more storytelling sessions, which definitely is something that appeals to kids and families. We also have a great bookstore right at Alphabet City that has a wonderful children's section that really reflects what City of Asylum is all about. A lot of multicultural books, books in other languages. And we really are looking over, as we start our 15th year and look toward the future, to see how we can do more with children as readers.
Right. In just a few sentences, you mentioned the future. So what's short term? What's long term?
Yeah, short term is kicking off this 15th anniversary, reminding everyone that City of Asylum is here and what we're doing in the community. And then looking really to expand some of our programs, some of our partnerships, like with the Pittsburgh Symphony, and expanding digitally as well so that we can reach more audiences around the country and around the world.
And you're going to keep incorporating more and more music, it sounds like?
Yeah, yeah. So right now our focus is really on jazz, and I'd like to see that expand out a bit.
All right. Mm-hmm. Kristen Weslow is the new executive director of the City of Asylum. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. What makes a county healthy? A study of Pennsylvania's 67 counties ranks them from best to worst in terms of health. Then, protests and vigils were held over the weekend for Antoine Rose. This followed the acquittal of former East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld, who was on trial for the fatal shooting of the unarmed teenager. High school and college students plan to walk out of classes today. In the wake of the verdict, what recourse does Antoine Rose's family have left? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Julia Zankovich with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Courier begins publication in 1910. Initially established in 1907, the newspaper gained national prominence after attorney Robert Lee Vann took over. By the 1930s, it was one of the top-selling newspapers for African Americans, and eventually one of the first to publish both national and local editions. The paper called for improvements for African Americans in areas such as housing, education, and healthcare, and protested misrepresentations of African Americans in the media. Today, the Pittsburgh Courier is published as the New Pittsburgh Courier. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After a personal experience with the challenges of seeking expert medical care, Stacy Flint of Garfield created Kyle's Hope. The organization advocates for other families and helps them secure quality care for their loved ones. Flint tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort that the Kyle in Kyle's Hope refers to her son, who was born with a terminal illness.
He was born with metachromatic leukodystrophy, which is a disease that progresses as he gets older. He was not supposed to make it 6 months, and then he wasn't going to make it until he was two. He is now getting ready to be 23, and he is still here with us.
What did you have to do to make sure that their diagnosis was correct, but that their prognosis was wrong?
Well, and at first they didn't know what it was. it took him until he was probably about three to actually come up with a diagnosis. They really had no idea, and I kept pushing and pushing and pushing and said, no, we're going to find this out. We need to look into this. We need to check everything.
And then out of your experience, you did what?
Out of my experience, I realized that there are so many people that have loved ones and they don't know what questions to ask, how to push the doctor, so to speak. They don't know how to make sure that the doctors are doing everything that they can. So I would sit in the waiting room at the hospital, talk to some of the families and just try to be encouraging to them and say, you know, why don't you ask them to look at this? Or so out of that, I realized that people just don't know where to turn. So I created Kyle's Hope, which is a where to turn service. So we provide care management, support services, referrals for in-home services. We do autism support services. Whatever the need is for the individual, we make sure that it gets set up and that it's followed through. We do everything we possibly can to make sure that every person has the best quality of life that they could have.
And what are some of the illnesses that the people you work with have?
Cancer, dementia, autism. We turn no one away.
And what difference do you think you're making in the lives of these people who have special needs?
The difference that I think we're making, and I would hope and pray that we will continue to make, is that they are still having the quality of life that they could have. No matter what the disability, the illness, they still deserve the best quality.
And you are a PhD in abnormal psychology. You have a regular job. How do you find time to operate Kyle's Hope?
God is blessing me. You know, sometimes I think to myself, wait, how do I have time to do this? But it just comes natural. If they call me, I'm here. I take lunch breaks and I go visit folks at the hospital and I make sure this person is having therapy and I go after work and I just keep it moving because it's all about giving the best quality. I treat every client as if they were my son, Kyle, and I know what I want for him, and everyone else deserves that too.
Dr. Stacy Flint, thank you for taking time to do the interview.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How readily available are physicians? How many hospitals are there nearby? What percentage of adults smoke? Just a few of the factors that could indicate just how healthy or unhealthy the communities are that we call home. The County Health Rankings and Roadmaps has issued its annual report ranking from 1 to 67 all Pennsylvania counties in terms of overall health. Allie Havrilla is an action learning coach with the program, which is a collaboration between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Welcome, Allie. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
What's the purpose of doing these rankings?
Yeah, great question. The rankings show us that where we live makes a difference in how well and how long we live. And they show us that not everyone has the same opportunity to be healthy where they live.
On your report, you have two main categories, if you would. Health outcomes, health factors. Can you lay out what each of those mean?
So health outcomes measure today's health, and health factors explore how healthy we might be in the future.
I mentioned some of the obvious criteria, availability of doctors, hospital, smoking rate. But what are some of the drivers of public health that don't necessarily immediately come to mind for many of us?
As you've mentioned, the rankings look at more than 30 measures that influence health, and many of those are factors that influence health outside the doctor's office or the hospital. And so I often point people to some of those social and economic factors, access to education, transportation, perhaps what the poverty levels look like in your community. And this year, we actually take a look at how a secure, affordable home is a critical foundation for good health.
Well, let me follow up on a couple of those. How does poverty affect health? Is it terms of access to food, access to doctors, affordability? What?
So when a family or a child is experiencing poverty, they might have to make choices or trade-offs to access the necessities that contribute to good health, those things such as healthy food or medicine or perhaps transportation to work and school.
And what about housing? Follow up a little bit on that. Give us a few details about how housing can impact the overall health of an individual and therefore the residents of a county.
Yeah, so this year our focus was on severe housing cost burden, which is when a household or family spends more than 50% of what they earn on their rent or mortgage. And I love, Kevin, the framing that you offered about both sort of the individual familial level as well as the community level. So starting at the family level, when most of a family's paycheck goes to housing, again, it's back to that, you know, what resources are left for some of the other necessities that contribute to good health. When we think about housing and its connection, you know, the connection at the community level, when a higher share of households face the burden of severe housing costs, within that community, there are also high rates of children in poverty, food insecurity, and self-rated poor health.
Union County is ranked as the healthiest, Philadelphia the least healthy in Pennsylvania. But is there a great gap, a great disparity overall, number one Union County versus number 67 Philadelphia?
For us, it's rather than thinking about it necessarily as a race to the top or to close that gap, it's what within your community are the opportunities to come together to take action to improve your health locally. So I guess I would say that, yes, there is a difference between the highest ranked county and lower ranked counties, and all counties, no matter their rank, have the opportunity to think about strategies and solutions to improve health.
Allegheny County, home to Pittsburgh, where we are, at least I am, is number 34, middle of the pack in the rankings. Is there a particular factor, behavior, that stands out to you regarding the Pittsburgh area, Allegheny County?
As you mentioned, Kevin, it is for health outcomes, it ranks 34 out of 67, and for the health factors rank is 25 out of 67, which, you know, so that's indicating that, you know, those health factors that explore how healthy we might be in the future are going in a positive trend. And so what I would then pose is, you know, so what's working well? What's going on in Allegheny County supporting a positive health factor ranking?
And conversely, if there is a category about physical environment, and Allegheny County ranks 66 out of 67, it seems to be mostly due to air pollution and some drinking water problems.
Yeah, that drinking water violations where it's a yes, no answer. And in Allegheny County, it is a yes. And, you know, this is one of the things where we always encourage folks to use the rankings as a starting point and dig a little deeper with some local data.
As an individual, we can dig a little deeper into this data. We can see what's impacting the overall health. But how is this data being used? Is this data being used by people who can really initiate change, who can enact change, whether it's policies or some sort of actions?
Yeah, so a great starting point to hear some inspiring stories of communities moving to action is the RWJF Culture of Health Prize Communities. And, you know, one example that comes to mind for me is a community, again, working at this intersection of securing housing and building wealth. And they took action to partner across community to provide the resources for affordable housing, work strategically to ensure that everybody's basic needs were met, and then together work to improve access and the pathways to access social services.
Was that a particular community you mentioned?
So that community comes from Missouri, and they're referred to as the 24-1 community. And it inspires me because it was 24 local jurisdictions coming together to think about what strategic approaches they could take to improve community. And, you know, I think if 24 local jurisdictions can collaborate, that inspires me.
And so you sort of point to that for other communities maybe to take note and duplicate?
Maybe not duplicate exactly, but again, it's thinking about what are the strategies and solutions that are grounded in evidence and have promising practice, and then what might need to be innovated or iterated on locally to make it fit for the context of community.
Allie Havrilla is an action learning coach with the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. The program is a collaboration between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Allie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Nikki Lane. Lane was born in South Carolina, but relocated to Nashville to launch her music career. Her debut album, Walk of Shame, was released in 2011. Lane's outlaw country style received critical accolades, but didn't catch on with the mainstream. Her second album in 2014 was produced by Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, which brought a wave of media attention and a much broader audience. Lane summed up her approach in a 2014 WYEP interview.
Okay, we made this country enough for dudes that only listen to country, but cool enough for the rest of the world.
In addition to her musical career, Lane also owns a Nashville clothing store named High Class Hillbilly. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Protests and vigils were held during the weekend in reaction to the acquittal of a former East Pittsburgh police officer for the fatal shooting of unarmed teenager Antoine Rose. High school and college students plan to walk out of classes today. Joining me in studio are WESA reporter Ann Lee Herring, who covered the trial all last week, and University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris, who also serves as WESA's resident legal analyst. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank Good you. To be with you, Gavin.
First, the trial itself, it concluded much faster than expected, both in terms of number of days of testimony and jury deliberation. So was that a bit of a surprise? I mean, I was hearing 2 weeks for this length of the trial. Annalee, let's start with you.
Yeah, it was quick, and I was surprised that it wrapped up as soon as it did. The prosecution called a total of 21 witnesses, and that lasted about 3 days. And then the defense just called 2 witnesses, Michael Rossfeld himself and their use of force expert, Cliff Jobe.
Were you surprised, David, by the speed of the trial?
I think so. I think it didn't go quite as long as people expected, but these things are never easy to predict. And as a defense lawyer, I can tell you that at times, the number of witnesses you're going to call, the amount of testimony you anticipate, is heavily influenced by how the prosecution's case goes. So they got to the point of their turn to put on a case, and they said, here's what we need, as opposed to what we thought we were going to need. And so it's always very dynamic.
When there was word that a verdict was coming down about 3 hours or so after deliberations began, that was an indicator probably acquittal, David?
I thought so, yes, because in a case like this that is complicated, if a verdict is coming back quickly, it either means there's overwhelming evidence of guilt, which there was not, and everybody conceded that, or a quick not guilty. If there is not enough evidence to keep the jury in the room for 3 or 4 hours in a case like this, and you know that they're going to come back, that really is trouble for the prosecution.
The jury had 5 options, not guilty or guilty of first degree murder, third degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, or involuntary manslaughter. So the prosecution got what they wanted there. For the jury to be able to consider a variety of options, didn't they, Annalee?
They did in that regard, but the key consideration in this case for the jury was whether Officer Rossfeld was justified in shooting Antoine Rose and ultimately killing him. And the way Pennsylvania state law is written, police officers really are given the benefit of the doubt. There's one provision that says if an officer reasonably suspects that a fleeing person has just committed a forcible felony, then that is justification for using deadly force. So that was a key factor here.
Did the prosecution blow it?
I don't think you can say that, Kevin. I mean, Ann Lee would actually be in a better position to make that judgment than I would, since she sat through the entire thing. But I don't see any evidence of that. I mean, there are curiosities like the fact that there was no expert witness on use of force for the prosecution. It made me wonder. But they charged, they went ahead, they presented their evidence, they did it in a strategic way. I don't think anybody can say that they laid down.
Yeah, I don't know that you could say that they blew it. There were certain obstacles that they faced.
That's right.
For instance, it sounds like they might have had some difficulty finding a use of force expert. It's really hard to say. We don't know much behind that decision or result there.
And that's because they didn't talk to the media afterwards, correct?
Yeah, they simply sent a letter to Patrick Tomasi, who was the defense attorney, saying that there was one use of force expert they talked to who said he just couldn't conclude whether or not the use of force was reasonable. And then they said others that they contacted said they wouldn't testify for personal or professional reasons. And then another thing that Attorney Tomasi highlighted it in his closing argument was the fact that the prosecution didn't call the driver of the car that Antoine Rose had been in, that had been involved in a drive-by before Officer Rosfeld shot him. But there were reasons that they said that witness would have been at risk. So that was just, didn't look the best for them, but something they couldn't really overcome.
David, use of force expert, would it have been appropriate? Sort of counter, because they probably knew the defense was going to call a use of force expert.
Well, I think it would have been not only appropriate, but expected for them to have their own. I mean, that's the way these cases go, whether they're in the criminal side or the civil side. You typically see one for each side. It's really hard to know what to draw from the fact that there wasn't one. Was it the fact that they simply stopped looking for one? Was it perhaps the fact that everybody they consulted said, you know, we really can't give you an opinion you're going to like? I mean, and that would indicate that this was a weaker case than people perceived. And I think that's behind a lot of the feeling that people have that maybe the prosecution didn't do its job, because a lot of people saw that video. They said, kid shot in the back while he's running away, open and shut. The law isn't that good in police cases for the prosecution. That's the bottom line. And you have to understand that first before you go anywhere else.
What do you mean by isn't that good? It doesn't make it as easy on the prosecution to convict?
The law favors the law favors the police officer in any case like this. It says that you have to look at what the actions and reactions of what a reasonable police officer would be in an objective sense, not even this officer, not 20/20 hindsight. You have to look at the fact that it's a tense situation where split-second decisions make a difference. And when you put that together with the jury's natural inclination to believe police officers, not every jury and not every person on the jury, but most jurors, you get a set of laws and instructions to the jury that favors the police. Now, that everybody may think that that's a great thing and that's how it should be, or you may disagree with that, but that's the legal reality. And because of that, these cases are very hard to prove. And generally speaking, the prosecution, prosecuting a police officer for this, would need an expert.
Yeah, and that reality, just thinking about the jurors' perspective on this, was another challenge the prosecution was facing. In addition to the fact that Antoine Rose had been in a car where there had been a drive-by shooting. So that was something that the prosecution just had to address. It didn't work in their favor, but they had to take that issue on because they knew that Rosfeld's attorney was going to highlight
Absolutely.
That and say that Antoine Rose was dangerous and he presented a danger to the community. So Patrick Tomasi, Rosfeld's attorney, had a simpler message to present, simply that Rosfeld was trying to protect the community and himself. And it was just a more straightforward point to try to distill.
Speaking of messages, the district attorney's office issued a statement following the verdict, expressing disappointment, believing in the jury system, etc. But then Saturday afternoon, after demonstrations had begun, they issued another statement saying, Quote, as was stated last night, our office disagreed with the verdict, and we understand the frustration of everyone who was hoping for and expecting a different outcome. However, the community needs to realize that when such frustration becomes hateful and violent, there will be ramifications for those involved in that behavior. Basically, a warning to protesters?
I think so, and I think it was a reaction to Friday night after the verdict was announced. There were shots fired at Patrick Tomasi's law office, so that clearly was a violent reaction and grounds for arrest if that person is caught.
Absolutely. You know, the depth of disappointment simply cannot be dismissed. This case is not something that stands alone. It comes against a long history here in the Pittsburgh region of cases in which black men, unarmed, die at the hands of police. And so often, maybe almost all the time, there is no verdict against a police officer. Now, again, you may think that's right, you may think that it's wrong, but you can't underestimate the way that that colors the feelings of the people watching.
Mm-hmm. Protests we've mentioned during the weekend, more planned this week as well. What are you hearing from protesters in the wake of all this?
The protesters who I've spoken to or seen covered by our other reporters this weekend say they're not surprised by the result. There's just this overwhelming sense of pessimism about the justice system. And really, I think the most realistic route to change the outcomes in these cases and what the activists will say is to change law on use of force.
Well, let me get to a brief follow-up with
sure.
you, David, about changing law. Is that even a possibility?
Well, they have to do that through the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania. And that is a Republican-led legislature with heavy majorities in both houses. They may not be willing to put that on their agenda or do it, but there are states where that is happening. There's a bill active now, two bills in the state of California. There's another one that I've become very interested in the state of Maryland, because the state legislature can do more to protect its citizens in under the Fourth Amendment search and seizure clause than the Supreme Court requires. They can't do less, but they can do more. So it's a possibility. The political realities in Pennsylvania don't leave you optimistic, but that is one way to attack this problem. Change the law to make it more to require police officers to do more before they shoot.
So we're just a minute or so left. What's the chance the family could pursue the case? Is there a possibility of a criminal violation in the federal courts, or is it strictly going to be a civil lawsuit?
It's a theoretical possibility only. There is no chance that the federal government.
You can ask the Justice Department to investigate.
Yes, they can. The Justice Department can be asked, but I see no chance this Justice Department will take the case on.
And on Lee, I know that there was a hold place, basically a stay on a civil lawsuit. What's happening there now?
This weekend, attorneys for the Rose family requested that stay be lifted now that the criminal case has wrapped up. So that's what to be watching next.
And who gets sued? Is it Rossfeld? Is it East Pittsburgh? Who gets sued in this case?
I would say it's both.
Yeah, it's both Rossfeld and East Pittsburgh, and also the chief of police from the former East Pittsburgh Police Department, which dissolved a few months ago, and also the mayor of East Pittsburgh, Lewis Payne.
And is there, in a sentence or two, is there one other thing other than changing the law that could help the community start healing?
Number one is we have to remember that this is a tragedy all around. No matter what we think of the law, this is a huge loss and a tragic outcome. We have to stop these things from happening in the first place. The law on the back end can't bring them back.
David Harris is a Pitt Law professor, host of the Criminal Justice Podcast, and a legal analyst for WESA. Ann Lee Herring covers government and courts for WESA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, spring is here and orange barrels will soon be popping up. PennDOT has unveiled plans for $300 million in construction projects this season in the Pittsburgh region. We'll talk with District Executive Cheryl Moon Sirianni about prioritizing projects when Congress and the White House can't agree on infrastructure investment. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Joya Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.